You're listening to episode 24 of 88 Cups of Tea with Ying Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Ying Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey guys! Before we get into today's interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. I fell head over heels in love with the writing software ever since I learned about how Scrivener helped my recent guest on the show, award-winning writer Jan Ellison, with her debut novel, A Small Indiscretion. You can check it out for yourself and try Scrivener for free for 30 days. If you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener hooked us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener for the coupon code.
Hey storytellers, hello from Malaysia. I'm visiting my grandpa and exploring the country my mom grew up in. It's so beautiful here and the food is incredible. I just came back from a very heavy breakfast. I had roti, which is similar to naan, savory taro root cake, bihun, which are these super thin noodles stir-fried with veggies, and kway diao tong, which are white noodles in a savory broth topped with seafood and meat. And yeah, that was all breakfast. I hope you guys enjoyed the narrative episode released last week. I have been itching to create an NPR-inspired episode for a while now, especially after chatting with all the inspiring guests on 88 Cups of Tea. The biggest universal takeaway I get from all my guests is to dive in and just create. Today, we're resuming back to our normal episodes of interviews with inspiring guests in the storytelling world. We have our very first children's book illustrator and author on the show with us today. I've been really excited about today's guest, and I'm so thrilled to finally share his episode with you. We have New York Times bestselling and award-winning author and illustrator Dan Santat, who's illustrated over 20 books for children. Dan is the winner of this year's 2015 Caldecott Medal. For listeners who may not be familiar with the Caldecott Medal, I'd like to say it's equivalent to winning the Oscars in the world of children's books. Yeah, it's a super big deal. Dan's book that won him the prestigious award is called The Adventures of Beagle, An Unimaginary Friend. The book begins on a magical island far away where an imaginary friend is born. He patiently waits his turn to be chosen by a real child, but when he's overlooked time and time again, he sets off on the incredible journey to the bustling city, where he finally meets his perfect match and at long last is given his special name, Beagle. I fell in love with Dan's beautifully illustrated story about friendship and the courage to find one's place in the world. The Adventures of Beagle, An Unimaginary Friend is displayed on my bookshelf and the book I bring out to show friends time and time again. Dan was so generous with his time and we chatted for 2 hours. I've split it up to two different episodes and today's episode is right around an hour for part one, where Dan takes us behind the scenes in his creation process for The Adventures of Beagle, An Unimaginary Friend, Dan's journey as an artist, and exactly how Dan got his foot in the door for the world of children's books. And next week, we'll air part two, where we dive into how Dan utilizes Facebook as a non-abrasive way of networking, why he turned down a huge job offer from Google, and a lot more that listeners can apply as actionable takeaways. Let's jump right into part one of Dan's episode.
What drew you to become a children's book author and illustrator? What made you fall in love with that?
I always grew up loving to do art. My parents, actually, they wanted me to grow up and be a doctor. And so most of my life was spent studying and trying to, you know, get into science and everything. And my parents, they never wanted me to take art classes because they thought it would discourage me from becoming a doctor. But I liked art so much that I collected comic books and I would just draw pictures and I would teach myself how to draw. And then I went to UCSD, got a 4-year degree in microbiology, got accepted into dental school. And then at the last semester, I thought, you know, I'm really going to regret life if I don't try to get into art school just to see if I could get in. And so I got a couple applications and I went all over San Diego because I was attending UCSD at the time. I went all over San Diego looking for figure drawing workshops and art classes just to flesh out some kind of a portfolio. And so by the time I graduated on graduation day, my parents say, they said, oh, are you ready to go to dental school? And I said to my dad, I said, well, you know, I got into art school and I really want to try that out instead. And I thought they were going to be furious, but they actually were very supportive. And they said, you know, well, we just want you to be happy. So, okay, why don't you do that? And so I got into art school, and this was around the time when, like, The Lion King and Disney was doing all kinds of animated features that were really just hitting the mark and really bringing Disney back to its glory days. And 3D animation was all the rage, and there were all these articles being put out about being able to make, you know, six-figure salaries doing animation for a living. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, like, working at Disney, working at, you know, a place like DreamWorks or something, that would be a dream come true. And so when I was in art school, I started taking 3D animation classes because I really liked animation. I grew up watching cartoons and probably some of my biggest inspirations. And then I took my first animation course and I hated it. I hated working in 3D. I remember I made a 1-minute animated film and it took like 14 weeks to do 1 minute of film. And I remember getting really frustrated and thinking, there has to be a better way to do this. And I ended up signing up for a children's book illustration course. And I just immediately fell in love with it. You know, there's certain formats, like, and picture books are 32 pages. There's a word count. And it sounded like it was a more efficient way to tell stories for kids. And then I wouldn't need a staff. I mean, I could be the writer. I could be the illustrator. And yeah, I immediately fell in love with it after taking that class.
How did you find the children's book world to be? Were they very warm and inclusive, encouraging, or did you feel it was a bit competitive?
Oh, no. The children's book community is probably the friendliest industry out there. I've been to book festivals where you'll go into the green room and, you know, you'll have your variation of children's authors and young adult authors and adult authors. And I find that a lot of the attitude among adult authors is, oh, you don't know who I am? Well, blah, blah, blah. I did this book about, I don't know, 30-day diet or whatever, you know? And everyone kind of looks at you with this disdain, like, how come they don't understand my genius? How come they don't know what my book is? And then, you know, you talk to other people who are doing children's books and, you know, they come up to you and they say, oh my gosh, I read your book. I love your book. And, you know, let's get to drinks after the panel. Let's go out to dinner later tonight. And, you know, we'll just talk about the business. And especially recently since winning the Caldecott Medal, I thought, wow, this is going to be a moment where people will probably roll their eyes and say, oh gosh, that guy won? Well, whatever. But I just got showered with emails congratulating me from, you know, from editors, from art directors, other authors, and especially other Caldecott Medal winners who called me or emailed me and said, listen, this is a really big thing, and, you know, you're going to be overwhelmed with requests to come speak at schools or do books, and it's going to be like a really off-the-wall crazy time for you. So if you need anyone to talk to, here's my number. Call me anytime.
Wow, that's really, really encouraging to hear.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And even, like, getting into the business, there's a great organization, the SCBWI.
Oh, yes.
And then you go there.
Could you explain a little bit to our listeners, for the ones who are not really aware of that or haven't heard of that?
Sure. So the SCBWI is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and it's this great organization for anybody who's interested in getting published and going into the business. They have chapters all over the country, and they invite everyone who's involved in the business, be it authors or illustrators, editors, art directors, to come and talk about the business and talk about how to get your foot in the door, from anywhere to how to write a manuscript, how to prepare an art portfolio. They do portfolio critiques. The very first one I went to was in 2002 here in Century City. And I went thinking, okay, I'm just going to show my portfolio. And I have my little 32-page dummy book here that I want to submit to an editor. There's like this portfolio display. And I remember putting my portfolio in the portfolio display, hoping I could, you know, drum up some work. And then this man comes up to me. And he says, hi, I'm Arthur Levine. I edit Harry Potter, and I saw your dummy book, and I love your portfolio, and I'd like to work with you. And then, like, a week later, I got a 2-book deal.
What? Oh,
yeah.
My gosh, that's insane.
So unfortunately, I don't have any of those struggle stories where people say, oh, you know, I sent out query letters for years and years, and I got rejected thousands of times. Like, the SCBWI was this organization that I went to, and it really was probably the best foot in the door for the business, by my recommendation, that I think.
Wow. So for our listeners who are really interested in checking them out, you can just join, sign up. Do you have to have a portfolio in order to go there?
I think membership now is like $80, and that's for a whole year. The website is scbwi.org. And with that, you get you get a quarterly newsletter, which is really well done. And then there's dozens of articles about how to get into the business and how to free your creativity or how to get inspired or talk about, you know, how to prepare for school visits. And then it has a calendar of what events are going on in your area. It also gives you a bunch of resources you can download. You can download a PDF of all the editors and art directors at different publishing houses and what they're looking for, and or if you're looking for an agent. For $80, you definitely get what you pay for.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a really great deal. And Dan, you draw so beautifully, and I want to know, how did you teach yourself?
I remember the first book I got was called How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. Because I wanted to know how to draw superheroes without having to look at pictures. Because when I started out, I had a paper route. And then with all the money I got from the paper route, every month I would go buy comic books by the armful, like X-Men, The Incredible Hulk, Spider-Man. And I was always amazed at how well the artist could draw. And I used to do this thing where, you know, I would sit down at a table in front of a TV, and then maybe the Dukes of Hazzard would be on or something. I'd sit there with a piece of paper and then a picture from one of the comic books that I really liked. And yeah, I would just freehand the drawing and try to copy it as close as possible. And I think what happens is that if you draw something many times, if you're repetitive about it, then your muscles, your hands, they learn things that your brain doesn't quite comprehend. And you start understanding things so well. Like I used to draw Garfield all the time and Calvin and Hobbes all the time, that after a while, you just know what they look like and you know how they should look, that eventually you can draw those things without having to look at it. I equate drawing to like riding a bike. You start off and things are a little awkward, but after a while, you get really good at riding a bike because repetition. And when you go to art school, that's basically what they do. It's no different than what I was teaching myself. They make you copy old master copies from people like N.C. Wyeth and John Singer Sargent and Dean Cornwell. And I think the idea is to paint the same paint strokes that they paint, and then you understand why they're doing the things that they're doing. The benefits of art school is that you have an instructor looking over your shoulder and saying, okay, this is why he did this, or you should be doing more of this, or this is what you're lacking. And then at the same time, you're also surrounded by a pool of really talented people who they're really great about trading knowledge and talking about their processes. And I feel like you find your work improving based on the talent that is around you.
And what inspired you to draw Beagle? So cute. How did you think of that specific body shape to the placement of the eyes and the cute little crown? You know, it's like every little detail. How did you come up with Beagle?
It's called The Adventures of Beagle, the Unimaginary Friend. And the idea is that these imaginary friends are born on an island and they wait for the day for a child to imagine them. And then once they're imagined, the stars pluck them up from this island and they take them to the child where they get their name. Now, one of the first pages in the book are the end papers. And in this spread, you have pairings of children with their imaginary friends. And for me, it was very important that these imaginary friends weren't generic, that, you know, they weren't just furry monsters with stripes and horns and spots and big teeth and everything. I wanted every imaginary friend to hold a specific purpose, a function within themselves, so that if you were to look at the imaginary friend, you could exactly know just by looking at the imaginary friend what this kid was passionate about. Like, for example, there's a picture of a kid that likes to fly kites, and so his best friend is the wind, this cloud. And then there's another kid who's holding a guitar. He likes to play music. So his best friend is a drummer, a little monster that beats his head with drumsticks, things like that. And I also didn't want it to be too obvious. There's a little girl that likes to jump rope. And, I easily could have used a rabbit, but instead I used a snake that had its body coiled up like a spring. And then with the rabbit, I actually used the rabbit to pair up with a boy who likes to do magic, like rabbit that you pull out of a hat.
Yes.
Now, with Beagle, well, the main point of the story is that you don't know who he belongs to because he's just so obscure. Like, you can't figure out what he is because he's a big white blob. And as you're reading the story, he's going through this adventure, and it isn't until the moment that you meet the girl that he's supposed to be with that you realize that the girl is a storyteller, and the whole book that you're reading is the story about how they meet. And originally, Beagle was supposed to be a blank sheet of paper. He was just going to be a piece of paper. And the problem with that was that I was worried that by that shape, it was going to give too much away. I thought people would look at it and go, oh, well, he's a blank sheet of paper. He's apparently has something to do with this book. And so I tried making him a little bit more amorphous and fleshing him out and giving him a pudgy little body, and then just letting the white part of his body represent the imagination, the creativity, the blank canvas, the ability to create whatever is in store. The book as a whole is actually a metaphor about the birth of my son. And I remember the day my wife told me that she was pregnant, the first thought in my mind was, you know, oh my gosh, can I do this? Can I be a good father? You know, I think for every guy out there or any parent out there, the initial wave of finding out that you're expecting a child is panic. Like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have a kid. Because, you know, suddenly you don't have to just worry about yourself. You have to raise something, and it's going to be for the rest of your life. And then after you get through that moment of panic, then it becomes more of curiosity of like, well, what is this person going to be like? What are going to be his interests? What is his personality going to be like? And the whole thing is a big, long, emotional journey trying to figure out how you two are going to fit as parent and child. You're terrified up to the moment when the child's born. Like, you're terrified. And then it isn't until you hold the child in your arms where all that fear and all that anxiety just immediately disappears, and suddenly you're doing it. You're a parent and you're holding someone in your arms that you've just met for the first time in your life, but you know without a doubt that you are perfect for each other and you love this person unconditionally and you would do anything. And it was something that I wanted to leave for my son, my kids, just as like a love letter to tell them how much I love them. And, regardless of it winning an award, having getting the book published and having it, exist for my son to put on a bookshelf and knowing that, you know, when he grows up, he can share it with my grandkids and his kids and then his kids' kids, his own grandchildren, things like that. Like that was a sentimental value of the book. You know, it's inspired by family. I always liked the idea of imaginary friends. But what I liked in particular was that imaginary friends are these creatures that they don't get a choice. They don't get a choice on who their friends are, you know? Mm-hmm. They exist for a reason, but it isn't until they meet the person that they belong to that they really understand their purpose. And it's like parenting, where you don't know whether or not you're going to be a parent, but then once you meet your child, you know exactly what you have to do.
Yeah, that was a beautiful backstory behind your book.
Thank you.
Did you take an actual like writing course? Because it's clear that you're very strong with art, but your writing is just as strong and it's to the point, which I think is one of the hardest things to do for a children's book, is to get straight to the point.
Right.
How was your process? Do you mind walking us through that from start to finish, the idea, even the thought of the name Beagle? Like, I freaking love that name. It's so cute.
So yeah, Beagle. Beagle was actually my son's very first word.
Oh,
and
that's so cute.
Beagle was his word for bicycle. Oh. And I remember the first time he said it, and he was pointing at a motorcycle. And my wife and I, we looked at each other and we said, oh, he's trying to say bicycle. And my wife looked at me and she said, that would be a really cute name for a character for a book someday. I think that was the thing that really said, okay, well, now I have this great name. I have to write a story for it. Our family has this, we have this silly history of my wife going to a pet store. And then if she finds an animal that's really cute, and if we stupidly name the animal before we even buy it, then it's like, well, we have to buy this animal now because we just gave it such an awesome name. So we have a dog named Pee-wee, and then we just bought a conure of this parrot. Like, my wife looked at it and was like, your name should be Tiki. And I was like, oh, just gotta go get my checkbook. And so my process for doing books, I wasn't the strongest writer when I first started out. But strangely enough, yeah, I think you can learn to be a good storyteller by any variation of storytelling, you know? I think it's funny when people say that television is bad for you, because when I was a kid, I inhaled television to a degree that from maybe most parents would gasp at. I watched cartoons, I watched movies, like HBO was all the rage, and I watched everything, like even things I wasn't even allowed to watch. And even now today, you know, like, I think it's such a good time for television. I'll sit there and I'll watch Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and, you know, all these great shows. But I think part of being a good storyteller is being aware of why things are being told. So you'll watch parts of Breaking Bad and you'll think, well, why is that character doing that? And I like to play a little game with myself where, like, right now I'm watching Game of Thrones and I'm watching
the
show.
So good.
It is so good. And I'm watching the show, and I like to play the game of, let me guess what will happen next week or what will happen to this character. Because I think it is a good exercise in trying to get into the mind of a character and understand why things are written the way they are. And then relating that to children's books, the brevity, you're right, the brevity of writing is really the hardest part of trying to be really economical with your words, keeping your word count down. I mean, you look at a book like Jumanji that came out in the 80s, and that manuscript is, I think it's like a 2,000 word manuscript or maybe even more. And to this day, a manuscript like that, you would never sell that. No one would buy that because that's just not the way the industry is anymore. Now you're looking at, if you're over like 700 words, then, you know, you're pushing it too far and you have to cut down the type. You have to cut down the text. I think Biko was somewhere around like 330 words. It wasn't a whole lot. But one of the golden rules in picture books is show, don't tell. The idea that illustrations should tell half of the story and the words tell the other half. And so with that in mind, I generally write a first draft of a book and then I break it up into page breaks, you know, into 32 pages. Mm-hmm. And then I'll look at the text and then I'll say, okay, what happens here in this sentence or in this paragraph that I can boil down to and not have to write in the text? So, like, for example, in Beagle, there's the spread where he realizes that he wants to leave the island and go find his friend. And so he builds a boat and he leaves the island. And the spread is, you see him on a boat that he built. And he's sailing off into the sea that's made out of clouds. And you have this giant rainbow dragon just intertwining all around the ocean and around him. And the only line that's in there is, he did the unimaginable. You know, I don't have to be redundant in saying, so he built a boat and he sailed off to the island, because the illustration's already doing that for you. Mm-hmm. The way I like to approach writing, specifically with picture books, is figure out what you want to say in each spread and then see how far you can take it with an illustration, and then actually use the text less for storytelling and more of being that little extra sprinkle on the top. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, last year was a really popular year for wordless picture books. So you know that you can tell a story without words. You see, you see, they've been doing black and white films like that for years. And so you're capable of doing it. And I think by having a book that can walk on its own two feet and then using the text to kind of make a dialogue that exists in between the lines, that gives more power to the text. Rather than having the function of trying to tell the story and explain what's going on, it gives the text the freedom to flex its ability to do other things, like be more emotional. There's definitely more emotion in saying he did the unimaginable than saying he left the island and went on his way to find a friend. I learn a lot from illustrating other people's books I've had the great fortune of working with some really great writers and just reading their works and studying how they do things. And again, taking that Game of Thrones approach and looking at their manuscripts and saying, well, why are they doing this? And then while I'm reading the manuscript, I play that game of, oh, well, this will probably lead to this and do this. I think I teach myself by reading other people's work. And after a while, I noticed that there's people who are very adamant about taking, you know, writer's courses and then adhering to a three act structure. And, you know, I like to say that that's one way to write, but it's not the only way to write, because if everybody writes that way, then everybody basically writes the same formula and you only have one kind of story, you know? Mm-hmm. There's many different ways to write, and really the best way to do it is just by getting down and dirty and doing it by yourself and, you know, not reading books on how to write. I think that's something that you figure out naturally by doing.
When you had the words down already for Beagle's story, did you have anybody go over and have their advice?
I had this great editor. Her name's Connie Hsu. Mm-hmm. And she would go through my text and, oh my gosh, we'd go back and forth. We'd have like 2-hour phone calls just talking about the motives of the character and so forth. So like, for example, Beagle wears a crown on his head, but it's a paper crown. And, you know, we're having these discussions about, well, if Beagle was imagined by this girl, then the girl would cover the crown by her own imagination. And it would probably be a really fancy, fancy crown. Like, she'd probably imagine a fancy crown on Beagle, you know? Mm-hmm. But instead, what you notice is that Beagle's crown is made out of paper and it has two little pieces of tape in the back. So there's more to the story. You realize, well, I guess it tells more of a story that's not being said. And these are the kind of things that the editor, you know, will have discussions about. You know, you talk about it and you say, well, if there's a paper crown, then maybe Beagle made this crown on his own to make himself feel better. Like, maybe it was like his security blanket. Mm-hmm. And with the text in itself, you massage the main points per spread. And then actually one of the best things that you do for a manuscript is you read it out loud. There's something about reading a manuscript out loud. And if you read it, like, you can hear the flaws. Like, it just doesn't flow correctly. If you're reading out loud and it doesn't roll off the tongue naturally, then you know that maybe you have to tweak some words. And so I would say a good one third of my time writing is me just reading the lines, and then if one gets tripped up, then I'll switch it with another word, or I might rearrange a sentence. But you know, like an editor is extremely anal about these things, where they'll say, well, if you say it that way, then it means this. It sounds a little bit more like more forceful. If you say it like this, then it sounds like it alludes to them wanting to, you know, discover something, you know? And it's like little details, little nudges here and there. But most of the time, the editor never tells you it has to be this. The editor will always ask you, what do you want to say? And then they'll read it and they'll say, well, that is not what you're saying. Or they will say, well, then you should say this in order to get your point across. Or it needs another scene. Or maybe there's a better example of doing this because it's not as strong. So Connie definitely was my guide in the whole process. And, and I really love, I've always made it a point to work with, you know, an editor, art director, who is constantly pushing me. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm always trusting my own instincts, you know? Like, I have my own confidence. I know what my strengths are. I know what my weaknesses are. But I always want someone whose opinion I can value and just make me, look at something and make sure that I explore all angles of it. And generally, like, I just finished a book recently, and I remember turning in a cover to sketch thinking, I'm ready to go with this cover. I really like this cover. And, you know, they took it into a board meeting and they said, well, we're having problems with this and this. And I got really frustrated. I thought, well, why don't they see it this way? And then they pushed me and they said, well, try different things. And I remember, gosh, usually I can knock out a sketch for a cover, after the second take. But I think I did like 4 or 5 different cover sketches. But it wasn't until I got to that 4th or 5th sketch where I realized, oh, this is a better solution. And, I'm glad that they pushed me to take it this far. So, yeah, no, editor and art director, tantamount. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. And how did you meet Connie? Was it through the conference?
Connie had contacted me like a couple years previous to illustrate a picture book manuscript that she got from another one of her authors. It was a book called Krankenstein. Mm-hmm. And, she had admired my work for years. And it was just the right manuscript that she thought I'd be perfect for. And we hit it off really well from the get-go. And, sometimes you have relationships with editors where you're thinking like, okay, well, I don't think this person and I necessarily, gel together. We don't jive. They don't see my sense of humor. They don't see what I'm trying to say. But then you get these magical moments where you meet an editor who just understands where you're coming from and you're like on the same wavelength and everything seems effortless. And so Connie is that editor for me.
That is so awesome. And I'm just a little curious too. When you are just starting to create and formulate your ideas and putting down sketches and the words, do you have a specific technique or process where it's like you write the words in index cards and then put it next to sketches and kind of figure it out from there? Or do you computerize everything? Like you keep everything on the computer so it's also another organized way of seeing your thoughts in front of you without
Right.
forgetting the idea? How's your process with that?
I'm kind of an odd duck where I don't write things down that often. My file cabinet is my brain, and I'll just sit there and I'll just think, and I'll look like some crazy person just sitting there like staring off into nowhere. Like if I take my kids to the playground, I'm like that parent that's just staring off. And I'm just have a blank look at my face, and maybe my wife will come up and be like, where are the kids?
Oh shoot.
The kids are over there, But I'll sit there, and for me, like a good story, 90% of the story is the concept and whether I can say it in one sentence. So I find that if you can get the concept down, then the rest of it falls into place really easily. And that comes from my background of studying advertising. It's always the form follows function. That's the mantra of most designers, like product designers even. Like, why did I make this chair? The functionality of it is to be comfortable, things like that. It was funny because in the illustration department, they always said, you have to have a style because people are going to hire you for the style. Mm. And the advertising teacher that I took, he was like the biggest influence in my life. His name was Roland Young. And he said, you need to be formless. You need to be the tool that fixes a problem. You don't want to be a wrench and say, I will fix every problem that you can, but I'm a wrench. You want to say, oh, what kind of problem is this? Then I can be that. So
right.
That has been my biggest success in finding all different diverse kinds of work, is that I don't necessarily have one style. I'm known as someone who can look at a manuscript and solve the problem at hand. And so because of that, I've had the opportunity to do graphic novels, middle grade novels, picture books, board books, toy design, video games, animation. There are people that I know who, all they do, they just love to draw. They love to draw dragons. And so they sit there and they wait for a dragon manuscript, mm-hmm. And you really pigeonhole yourself by doing that and just sitting there and waiting for the right job, being able to think with an open mind and be malleable, to be flexible and think of different things, like that's truly a gift. And I'm sorry, so I went off track, but going back into the idea of writing, the idea is to sit there and my idea is don't think of a character and put them in adventure. Think about the quest. Think about what the character wants. and then think about the perfect character that would be a good protagonist for that. So the idea, like in Beagle, for example, the idea of someone wanting to make their first friend, mm-hmm. not knowing what their purpose is, not knowing if they're going to have the same interests as a person. I love the idea that an imaginary friend takes it upon themselves to choose or think that they have the opportunity to choose who their best friend is. Mm-hmm. When in essence, along the journey, they not only go through the struggles of discovering what they want, but also realizing who they are. The idea of an imaginary friend, if you look at it from a different perspective, fills many functions for the role of the story.
Yeah.
And so, but like I said, that idea is something that it really takes a tremendous amount of effort to boil down into one sentence. Because that's also, I hate to say it, that's also your sales pitch. That's the thing that you tell an editor, you know, what is the story about? Oh, it's about an imaginary friend who hasn't been imagined yet that wants to find the child that he belongs to. Like, if you just say that, it sounds interesting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of successful stories that stem from that idea of being able to boil it down into one simple sentence.
To me, I'm like, wow, that is such a gift to just cut it down to, like, one sentence or two words, you know? I remember the spread where you had the desert, and there was just two words, but they were so powerful.
The brevity of the thing is what gives it the power. So
exactly.
Going back to advertising, what they address is symbology, the ability to take the problem and boil it down to one image. So for example, take the Got Milk campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You show a plate of cookies, that makes you think of milk.
That's true.
And all you have to say is Got Milk.
Mm-hmm.
That's effective advertising. If you want to talk about a commercial that probably drives advertisers crazy, look at those stupid Geico commercials, you know? And it's like, hey, get it? We're called Geico, but it's a gecko, and it says nothing about the product. It says nothing about my product. You just have this stupid lizard going around like, oh, I have a British accent, and I can save you money. And it's like, you're so, any sensible person I know that wants to get good insurance, Geico is the last place on earth they will go to get insurance, you know? You're the guys that make the funny commercials, you know, be it, for a while they were doing Cavemen, and I'm like, I don't know this has to do with anything with insurance. The brilliance of advertising is actually talking about the product and telling them why you should get the product.
Yeah.
You know, in mm-hmm. as fewest words as possible. The longer it takes for you to explain something, the quicker they're going to lose interest. And that's basically, sadly, that's the whole universe now. Like, that's why you can't write a Jumanji anymore. People don't want to sit down and take the time to read it. They want to get right to the point. And the better you are at the brevity and getting right to the point, the more powerful you're going to be. And that's, I mean, honestly, I think that is the secret. I think that is the secret to the universe of writing these days. It's getting straight to the point. And you're right, it is the hardest thing to do. But if you can do it, and I, you know, believe me, it can be taught, because I took an advertising class. For anybody that is listening, like, take an advertising class. That is huge. To be a good illustrator, I say, take an advertising class, take a graphic design class. You don't take a drawing class. Take a graphic design class, because that tells you how to organize your information. Take an advertising class. That tells you how to communicate effectively. You will rule the world with just those two classes.
That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's really freaking helpful.
Sure.
And very invaluable information. I want to touch back a little bit as well when we were talking earlier. And you mentioned that you met your editor through... she found you
mm-hmm.
and was asking you to come on board and help illustrate other books.
Right.
Now, for our listeners who are like me, who love writing but can't draw for their life, So the editor would link me up with an artist like you, an illustrator like you, and then do we get together in a room? Like, how have your processes been?
Well, the old model was that you would find an editor at a publishing house, and then you would write an inquiry letter, a one-page letter saying, I have this story, this is what it's about, would you be interested in reading the manuscript? And now publishing is a very old-fashioned business where you can only address one editor at a time. So you say, here's my inquiry letter. I will wait for you to either say yes or no. And then, you know, 6 months could go by, 9 months could go by, and then you get it back. And if it's a no, then you send it to another editor and you sit there and you wait. I am waiting for you to say yes or no. And that could, again, take another 6 or 9 months. These days, publishing houses have downsized quite a bit. So they don't have a whole lot of staff to go through slush piles and address inquiries. So typically now they like to take on a lot of agented materials. Like, they won't take anything unsolicited. But if you do have an agent, that agent has the freedom. They have a little bit more wiggle room. They can share it with more than one editor at a time. They have their favorites. They have editors that they've worked with before. But what happens is that the editor-agent relationship is, I've worked with you before, Mr. Agent. You are vetted. I trust the material that you have with your clients. So rather than dealing with 80% of those people who have absolutely no idea how to do a picture book, I am narrowing my search down to you, who've sold manuscripts to me before. I trust your taste. Let's see what you have going on. I think that's pretty much the new model now of finding a literary agent and then having them get your manuscript into fighting shape and then sending that out to publishers and then getting a bite. And from my point of view, I feel like the publishing industry's moved a lot quicker because of that. And so that typically is the way of getting into the business. Now, in terms of getting an agent, that might be a little bit trickier. That might be actually the biggest obstacle of the thing, because there's lots of agents, but I would have to say that there's only a handful of really good ones. You know, to get that author's attention, to get someone to say, hey, you're worth representing even though you've never published before. You could start off in magazines. I know a lot of authors who would write articles in like Highlights or, you know, any number of magazines. But just to show that you have a track record of publications, that someone has paid you before to write things. And then just kind of building a relationship with them. You know, if you were to, say, go to an SCBWI conference and meet this person, then, get to know them, see if they're the right fit. You know, there's grants that could be won. You can win a writer's grant. That also helps, or, things like that. And now, once you land an agent, and then that agent successfully sells your manuscript to a publishing house, to an editor. Now, this is interesting because the traditional means of getting the book completed is that once you submit the manuscript and it's been proofread and edited, then your job as an author is done. You have no other say with the book. They like to separate the author from the illustrator because they don't want the author's vision to muddle the illustrator's vision. Because the idea here is that you're the author, you're good at the words, but the illustrator is good at the pictures, the visuals, and you need to keep your opinions to yourself because you have to trust that person because they are very good at what they do, and you have to trust our judgment that we pick the right illustrator for this manuscript.
Oh,
the publisher,
wow, okay.
The publisher handles acquiring the manuscript. They handle obtaining an illustrator for the project. They find out where it lands on the schedule. They figure out the publication date, publicity, any kind of advertising that has to go with it. It's not your job as the author to have to find an illustrator. The publishing house gets a lot of inquiries from illustrators as well. So they're not short of talent, or they might have an illustrator or someone that they've worked with for years who is probably amazingly reputable. Sometimes what they like to do is they like to take a first-time author and then they'll pair that author up with a well-known illustrator because that's the selling point of the book, despite what your hopes and dreams may be. People are really going to gravitate to a book if there's a familiar name on that jacket.
Gotcha.
Again, like I said, that's the old model where they separate the author and illustrator. But what I've noticed is that in the last, I would have to say 6-7 years, is that social media has completely
changed everything,
torn those walls down. And, you know, I will suddenly get messages on Facebook saying, I'm so excited that you're illustrating my book. and then maybe I'll turn in the sketches. And then the author will say, oh, I got the sketches. I think they look fantastic, you know? And then there's even these weird things where I find that I think contractually, or I don't know if it's something that the editor and author worked out, but sometimes I'll get author notes and I'm thinking, that's weird. You know, 6-7 years ago, that never happened. And now I'm getting 2 cents from the author. I think maybe it's more often a case of, you know, a professional courtesy of like, well, you know, they want me to pass these notes on to you, but you don't have to listen to them unless you're working with, you know, like, you know, I've worked with some big name authors who the publishing house just bows down to everything they say. And it's just like, well, so-and-so wants it done like this. And you kind of have to adhere to it, you know, because of who they are. I have to say, like, I think a good 85% of your success in children's publishing is just knowing the rules, you know? Yeah. You know, you can pick up this great book, you know, like The Complete Idiot's Guide to Children's Publishing. It really is like a great map on how to get published. It addresses all those things. You know, coming out of art school, I remember buying that book and just reading it from cover to cover multiple times. And you can go to a conference and you can see someone who they probably have the right intentions. They probably have a good idea. But then the thing that they write might not necessarily be a picture book. You know, they might actually be writing in middle grade, but they're not aware of it because they're not aware, you know, they're not aware that a picture book is supposed to be 32 pages. They're not aware that editors don't want to look at a manuscript that's over 700 words. You know, that's the thing that an editor will look at and say, well, this isn't even worth my time. This is like a 20 page manuscript for a picture book. And there should be any more than 2 or 3 pages, you know.
That's so true. Dan, thank you so much for all of that.
Sure.
Wow, you've been so helpful.
Yeah.
I'm not even kidding. I want to know what your take is on the whole networking situation. How do you think that applies to being a children's book author and or illustrator?
For me, I think it's been invaluable. In particular, when I was starting out, my first order of business was I wanted every art director and editor to know who I was because I wanted that opportunity to be that person that's in their mind to be considered for, you know, an illustration job. So what I did was I would meet a lot of people at conferences, or I would go out to New York and I would meet people at like award banquets and things like that, book expos, things like that, and you get to know them. And my first thing is I would gather names from people in the publishing, and I remember I would friend them on Facebook. And for me, like, I knew that my value, my strongest asset was illustration. Traditionally, what happens is that illustrators send out postcards, you know, and then they mail it out to the publisher, and the publisher looks at the postcards and says, I will consider this person for illustration work. And I took the angle of friending editors and art directors on Facebook, and rather than soliciting them and saying, I would like you to work for me, I would just show an illustration that I was working on.
Hey guys, that's it for part one. Be sure to tune into the second half of Dan's interview next week. We'll get right into how Facebook is a great networking tool and a ton more actionable steps you can walk away with. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Thanks so much to Dan for being so candid and so generous. He's an absolute inspiration and I'm thrilled to have him on the show. And thank you guys for listening as always. Be sure to check out www.dantat.com, that's DANTAT.com, to check out more of Dan's work. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this episode. And to do so, reach out to me on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at 88 Cups of Tea. For the list of resources and books mentioned in Dan's episode, be sure to visit 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/DanSantat.
A heartfelt thank you to Scrivener for making this episode possible. I've honestly been having a bit of trouble keeping the ball rolling with a story that I want to write. A lot of times I make excuses to myself not being able to write for the day because I can't seem to find that great idea I jotted down for a chapter or the latest draft of that excerpt I wrote. Having Scrivener helps me a whole lot in getting rid of those excuses for myself. I'm honestly still having a bit of trouble committing fully to writing that story, but Scrivener makes things a lot easier for me when I'm feeling extra brave that day and tackling characters, ideas, and the the story structure. I actually learned about Scrivener through one of my recent guests on the show. You may have heard her episode. It's the one featuring award-winning writer Jan Ellison of A Small Indiscretion. I've been using Scrivener for almost everything that involves writing ever since Jan raved about the software. Scrivener has truly helped make my life easier, and I'm excited to share this company with you. If you're a storyteller and haven't tried Scrivener out for yourself yet, you need to download their 30-day free trial. Give it a go, and if you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener is hooking us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener for the coupon code.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!